Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations. My name is Phil Strum. Thanks for joining me today. My guest today is one of my favorite people in pro wrestling. It's the legendary writer and photographer, Bill Apter. If you grew up in the 80s like I did, Bill Apter was the face of Pro Wrestling Illustrated and that family of magazines. He was the most visible photographer at ringside, as well as the guy who would make the presentations of awards to the wrestlers. But wrestling magazines were all in character, so how did the internet change things? Well, nowadays you can see Bill on Sportskeeda and on social media, interviewing just about everyone. The way he handles himself professionally is just awesome. He's done so much, and he's been in so many different fun spots in his career. He introduced Andy Kaufman to Jerry the King Lawler. He's known Vince McMahon for over 50 years. He's worked with pretty much every star across wrestling over the course of a very long career. When I interview people, I strive to treat them with the same respect that Bill Apter does for wrestling and pro wrestlers. Also, he's a great karaoke buddy of mine. I am so excited for you to hear my interview right now with Bill Apter. So honored to be joined by one of the nicest people in pro wrestling. For over 50 years, this man has documented...
Wait a minute, shut up. Don't say that.
In a variety of ways. He's best remembered by many from his work in wrestling magazines. It's Bill Apter. Bill, welcome to Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversation.
Thank you. It is great. You know, it's funny that your the name of the show, which I love it, is Under the Ring, because people always ask me, during my prime days with the magazines, when you die, what's the ideal situation? I said, I'm going to be shooting pictures at the ring. There's going to be a riot. I'm going to go under the ring, and it's going to collapse on me. So very, very apropos name of the show to bring me on to. And it's great to see you.
Great to see you. Well, how have you been? What have you been up to?
Oh, my God. I mean, I do. I juggle two careers every day. Let me just adjust my lighting here. So during the day, I'm a job coach. I help people with disabilities to find real jobs, not, hey, you've got a disability, go to a fast food place and wipe tables. And if that's what they want to do, that's great. And as soon as I get home, and at times during the day, I change into my out of my Clark Kent costume, and I go to work for Sportskeeda. I've been with Sportskeeda Wrestling for about a year and a half right now. And if you go to their video channel, Wrestle Binge, just the way it sounds, Wrestle Binge, you can see my videos several times a week. As a matter of fact, and I still have the One Wrestling video station as well, BillApter.com. But as a matter of fact, I did an interview with Sergeant Slaughter. Part one ran last week, and within 3 hours, we had close to 100,000 views, which I was shocked. Eddie Strum.
That's great. Going back in your career, being involved with Stanley Weston and his magazines for many years, what was it like being inside of a world that so few people had access to?
Oh,
wrestling is so different than it is today.
It was great because he had his office in his house, and the editorial offices were near the bedrooms, and the art department was on the other side of his home. In his office, in his basement, he had all the photo files, and I was the guy responsible for developing pictures and taking the photographer packages that were getting sent by the various freelancers and filing them. But he always told me, he said, no matter what you hear in this place, anything about wrestling, you don't repeat it anywhere. And that was the first real indoctrination into the wrestling business, keeping kayfabe at the magazines.
Yeah. How important was Stanley to pro wrestling? That was really a dream team that you guys had, at least when I was reading it, when I was growing
up. He was long before me. He's the guy who created the first wrestling magazine I ever bought in 1959, maybe, was on sale at Sunnyside Garden, and it was 50 cents, and it was Wrestling Review. And his other publication was Boxing Illustrated Wrestling News. The wrestlers loved being in his magazine. He was very important because they knew he was kind of the original version of me in some ways. they knew, you know, they could get their pictures published, et cetera. And they did everything they could to help him. And he had a lot of close friends that kind of passed the word around that he was good, like Al Costello from the Fabulous Kangaroos. Ricky Starr, they were very close friends of his. And yeah, they put the word out there. And actually, he started his business on a green kitchen table in their kitchen. That's where he wrote the first issue of Wrestling Review. He got, unfortunately, when he started coming out with the early issues of The Wrestler and Inside Wrestling, he got a lot of wrestlers angry at him. Which hurt me at the beginning of my career. He ran a story of This Is Your Life on that guy over here, Bruno Sammartino. We had Bruno's sister, like 5 years old, killing a Nazi in Italy. And Mil Mascaris was upset. When I met him, he said, "Who wrote that story?" He says, "My family is not grow up in an adobe hut. They were dentists, doctors, professionals." So, and Andre the Giant was furious at one of them because it said that Edouard Carpentier was his hero, and that wasn't true. So I had to go in, and one of the first people that I met, I was doing a radio show in New York. I bought my own time. And one of the first, I got press tickets, and I went to Sunnyside Garden in Queens on Queens Boulevard, and I met Gorilla Monsoon. And he said, "Who do you work for?" I said, "Stanley Weston." He said, "Well, you're not welcome here." "Whoa." I said, "What happened?" He said, "You know what? The Sammartinos and I are a very close family. He sent a photographer to my house to do an at-home with Gorilla Monsoon story. And I showed him my gun collection. And I held one gun up like this. And the headline came out, I might do this to Monsoon." And oh, my goodness. So Monsoon said that he'd give me a chance, you know, to see if I could do any better. And I got to meet Bruno, and I said, "You know what, I'm working for him, and I will straighten this out." And I did the very first shoot interview with Bruno. Wow. In any magazine. Bruno was very upset because he said, like, "This Is Your Life story," embarrassed he and his family because none of it was true. So, so after a while, I got to meet Vince Sr., and he also said, "Well, if you're working for Stanley, you're not too popular here, but we'll give you a chance." And that put the key in the ignition. They all wanted to be on my, let me see if I can find this, on my old radio show that was on WHBI 105.9 FM in New York. I bought my own time. And, I have a whole series of audio cassettes back from when I started in the mid-60s doing that radio show. And I still have most of those interviews, and I run them on my YouTube channels periodically. So yeah, that's how it happened. And word started getting around, hey, that actor's okay. And here I am 51 years later.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, you know, like you mentioned with your publications being,
well, remember, they weren't my publications. Everybody,
the publications you work.
They're the After Mags. Dave Meltzer came.
I never called them the After Mags.
No, but Dave Meltzer came up with that terminology, and it's driven me crazy. I'm flattered.
It's endearing.
You know, that. But like you, working in newspapers, we had an entire editorial department, and I was one of the people in the editorial department. But the promoters started to say, "Hey, this guy can talk. He dresses nicely when he comes to our shows. Let's put him on TV." So the next chapter.
I remember when I met you was actually at the WrestleMania 30 press conference at the Hard Rock Cafe in Midtown Manhattan. And I told you that your magazines were basically the first things I'd ever read. And you looked at me and told me, well, you probably looked at a lot of my pictures too. Yeah. I think it's hard for people to understand now that you can't just look up easily back then, you know, what happened in the companies that you didn't follow. Like, I remember when I was a kid, if I wanted to know what the Rip Oliver was doing in Portland, I had to buy Pro Wrestling Illustrated.
Yes.
What was it like to be the key to publicity for so many people?
Oh, I loved it because every week, every Monday, I called every wrestling office. I'd call Vince McMahon Sr. at home. And his wife, Juanita, would always answer the phone and go, oh, Vincent, it's that nice young man from New York, Bill. And then I'd call Jim Crockett and he'd always say, hey, what's the scuttlebutt going on here? Don Owen in Portland would go like, I don't want to talk about that. I don't need my magazine. Hang up. He was very Gary Hart and I would talk every Monday. He was Fritz Von Erich's booker. Florida, I talked to Gordon Solie. Generally, and oh, you know, I absolutely adored him. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it was great because they were expecting my calls. The one call every Monday, though, that I looked forward to, but I needed to spend time was Jim Ross. When he was working for Bill Watts, I would just say, what's going on? And he'd go without a break for 45 minutes while I was trying to write it down.
Imagine that.
Maybe I got two lines from in a column from that.
Jim Ross could talk. Imagine that.
Yeah. One good thing, old JR.
He's great to deal with, though.
He sure is. He is one of the real legends of the business. He and I started close to the same time.
Yeah.
And I respect that he's still around.
One thing when I've dealt with wrestlers, my background, as you said, is journalism. So I try to treat everyone fairly and in a journalistic way. Mm-hmm. But watching the way that you deal with wrestlers, and I've told you this before, is something that I aspire to. You treat them all with respect and you don't poke fun or make light of anything that they're doing.
No.
How hard was it for you to gain trust within the wrestling community?
It was very difficult at the beginning until that Bruno story that I did the shoot interview with him, and he spread the word around. Then Mr. Weston would call various promoters that he was close with and said, you know, this guy is smart to the business. That's what his voice was like. But that didn't matter, really. I had to make sure that I listened when I needed to listen. I never asked if titles are going to change. I was like a Sports Illustrated reporter and photographer going after a story. Wrestling for us in the magazines was totally done as if everything was real. And that's what we based it on. Even though we came up with incredibly unusual stories back then, we always stayed within the angles. And sometimes the wrestlers would call us and say, hey, that angle you did with us, we weren't doing that, but we're going to do that now. So, it was very easy after a few years to gain the trust of the wrestlers and a lot of the promoters, too.
What, as you look at wrestling journalism?
Well, Phil, actually, what I want to add to that is it depends how you present yourself. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the people on the internet right now, they'll go to a story and they'll to a match and they'll have a press conference and they're asking all these, well, you know, why did the so-and-so do this? And he sucked in the ring. We never did anything like that. They were an athlete and we were covering a story. That's what, and they knew that's what I was. And a lot of them knew that I personally could give them publicity because I was the guy out there. And I'd go back to the editors in the office and say, we got to do something like this. This is big.
Yeah, and it's interesting from my perspective is I've never wanted to be the guy to like review the shows and break down every single move that's happening. My idea for this show was pro wrestlers are some of the most interesting people I've ever talked to. Mm-hmm. And if I can have nice, good, long conversation, longish, kind of short because it's half hour, but conversations with them, you know, all the better. It's just I think people will find things interesting hearing from them.
Sure, absolutely.
More than hearing from me, necessarily.
But a lot of them in the current day and age reveal things, and everybody knows that it's, you know, this is an stuntmen doing a great thing in the ring and entertaining, and the finish is predetermined. And I don't, you know, I don't really like that kayfabe has completely, you know, just completely been broken at this point. First time I ever heard the word, first time, I was in Philadelphia, and I walked into a dressing room, and Phil Zacco, the promoter, had some issues with Mr. Weston. And he said, "Who do you work for?" He said, "Stanley Weston." He said, "Get the hell out of here." And I hear all the wrestlers going, "Kayfabe, kayfabe, kayfabe." No idea what it was. So then a few years later, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I walked into a dressing room, and Tommy Young, the referee, was in there with Blackjack Mulligan and a few other guys, and Mulligan, somebody yelled out kayfabe, and Tommy says, "Kayfabe him? He's been doing this longer than any of you." Yeah. But I never understood that it was a word that came out from the carnival circuit,
right,
when they didn't want someone to know something or to hide something. They'd say kayfabe. And Gorilla Monsoon's license plate, by the way, on his car.
I heard that. Yeah.
Kayfabe. Yeah. Yeah.
You talked about it a little bit, and this was kind of the next question that I had on my notes too, but what is important? What do you see that's important about wrestling journalism as so many more people have a voice, like in the current 2023?
Oh, landscape? What I see is people just ripping things all the time. So much of the internet wrestling community is nothing but complaining.
It's negative.
Yeah, yeah. But I look at a guy like Mike Johnson at PW Insider, and to me, he is what the current internet crop should be. I don't like revealing a lot of things, but I find when I'm doing my interviews for Sportskeeda or the After Chat, that a lot of the wrestlers, even though I'm staying in their character, they're breaking kayfabe now too.
Right.
You know, they're making like everybody knows. But I love the internet community. They've been great to me, really, really great to me. But I just think there's too much negativity.
Yeah. And I think you can find the line there of being critical and not just being overly negative. You can be critical without being.
Oh, you know, someone's match really sucked. You know, I hated it. Don't watch him again. Why would you do that? Hey, so-and-so's match wasn't up to par tonight. It surprised me a little bit, but maybe next time he or she will give a better performance.
Yeah, it's definitely it's kind of a fan culture you see in a lot of different genres nowadays too. From what
You know what changed that in wrestling?
What's that?
Three letters, ECW. That fan became a whole new kind. We had never seen the fan that would yell out, "You effed up." Mm-hmm. Or stuff like that before ECW. I'm not blaming them, but it changed the fan completely. A lot of today's fans, WWE fans, are not that group of fans, but AEW fans, I find a lot of them are those kind of fans. When I was watching Dynamite the other night, it was amazing that all the fans were yelling, "You effed up," at one of the spots here. And Warner Brothers Discovery might have been going like, and even the language, I found out through Sergeant Slaughter in the recent interview I did with him that he said the reason Vince started scripting stuff is back in the days like when CM Punk would come out and curse on TV, Vince didn't want any of that. He thought it would be very bad for the sponsors. So that's why he started integrating more script into this thing. I never knew that before. But that's what the Sarge told me, and I cannot.
You can control the situation better when you know what's going to be said.
It doesn't have to be word for word, but it should be classy.
If you go back and watch some of those old Madison Square Garden shows, and that's probably the history that I'm most fascinated by is New York, probably because
I was there.
You were ringside sometimes, George Napolitano, sometimes Paul Heyman too. What was a day like, and what was it like being there for all those big moments, and even some of the mundane ones, probably?
What was the day like?
Of pro wrestling?
I would leave the office in Rockville Center, Long Island, New York, get on the train about 1:30, 2 o'clock, get to Manhattan around 2:15, 2:30. I would go to the Holland Hotel on 42nd Street between 8th and 9th Avenue. And I'd walk up three floors, to the third floor where Capital Wrestling had a little office with Arnold Skolin, Gorilla Monsoon, Angelo Sivaldi, and a bunch of other guys all smoking and playing poker. And Arnie would give us our press ticket. It was just a walk-in ticket. So after that, a few of us would meet and have dinner at Angelo's restaurant across the street from the Holland Hotel. And then about 6:15, go to the garden and to the employee's entrance up to the sixth floor in the elevator. And bingo, that's where all the wrestlers were hanging out in the hallway. And I do my interviews. And George was there all the time, too, by the way.
Yeah.
And I'll do my interviews, shoot pictures, schmooze with Vince Sr., Vince Jr. when he started coming around. So it was great. It was being special backstage and making them feel special that the magazine was interested in them, and me feeling special that they kind of were taking a liking to me, because I was a fan since I was 12 years old.
Do you remember what your first MSG show as a ringside photographer was?
And I don't. I do know it was Bruno in the main event, but I don't remember. It's probably 1971 or the end of 70, a month or two before Bruno lost the title to Koloff.
Nice. As moving on, as you saw the Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler saga play out, How did you feel about that and your role in that, if people don't know about
that?
Well,
my role in it is like, and I use this a lot, but I put the key in the ignition. Andy had come to the garden a lot backstage. And I remember saying to Vince Sr. one time, you know, the guy wants to wrestle. He said, no, he's a nice kid, but we don't want to look bad. We don't want to. And Vince Jr. had him on at ringside a couple of times on some interviews. So Andy knew me from the magazine. He said, what are you doing after the matches? I said, well, I'm going home to my apartment in Queens. He said, where do you live? I said, Queens in Kew Gardens. He said, how do you get there? I said, subway. Now, here's the guy who's starring on Taxi. Starring on Taxi, the number one hit comedy show. And he's on the subway with me going back there. At that time, I was rooming with Susan Sexton, the Australian girl wrestler, and I walked in and to the apartment. Everything she said was with the F-bomb. She'd say, oh, hi, Bill. Oh, hi, F and Andy Kaufman. And it's like, so after about 3 hours of us chatting, she says, is that all you can talk about to him, wrestling? He says, yeah, I want to be Fred Blassie or Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. So she went in the bedroom, put on her headphones, put on the Blast of the Ramones, Gabba Gabba Hey, and that was the last we saw of her. So I said, Vince McMahon isn't interested, but I have a friend in Memphis. He says, oh, I've seen those things in the magazine. I said, they have characters like the Wolfman and Frankenstein, and they're way ahead of the level where they do like almost entertainment. I said, why don't we call Jerry Lawler? And he said, well, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, it's midnight there. We're wrestling people. We're up all night. So I called Kaufman. He says, you got Andy Kaufman, the guy from Taxi, in your roach-infested apartment? I said, yeah. I put Andy on, and that was the start of the whole thing.
And as that kind of progressed, like, did that kind of just blow your mind to see how big that it got?
Oh, my God, when they did the Letterman show.
Yeah.
It was totally amazing. Now, Mr. Weston was a lot like Vince Sr. He didn't want entertainment in the magazines. So the day after that, Lawler was coming out to the office on Long Island. I said to Mr. Weston, I'd like to send a car to get him. Let him take the railroad. And here he was, like the guy that a zillion people saw on TV, taking the Long Island Railroad and signing autographs.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So you've known the current Vince McMahon for over 50 years.
Junior, yes, forever.
And obviously you knew his father. What's your relationship been like with him over the years, and what's it like now?
Well, it was horrible for a long time. And he told me never to take it personally.
Interesting.
He started his own magazine. He offered me the job as an editor on the magazine. I turned him down because I said I'm loyal to Stanley Weston. And after a while, I was told by our magazine distributors that Vince's people were calling them, telling them not to take our magazines anymore. He's going to block access to all. And he did that. And anytime he'd see me at an arena, which was rare because we usually sent a photographer to shoot from the stands because I didn't want to embarrass me and I didn't want to embarrass him. So there was very, very little contact there. I met Linda McMahon at one point at a WrestleMania affair. And she said, you know, when I went to WOW magazine, she says, you're always family to us, but we can't help you at all. But eventually when their business started going down, I jumped ahead there. When business started going around the Nation of Domination time, I got a call that they needed some photos for something. And I said, well, I can't do it unless I can get access. And that opened it up for me, only me, to start with. And then little by little, they started letting George back in.
And then
nowadays, they know that I don't go in with a camera or recording device. Nowadays, I go backstage and see the family. And because it's family to me, I've been doing this for 51 years. And it's cool to me that a lot of the young wrestlers know who I am. Oh, we used to buy, no matter what I do, it's like the singer that does a 3-hour concert, but they only want to hear that one hit song. It's the same thing with me and PWI. No matter what I do, all the TV shows I was on, the Crockett TBS shows, Joe Pedicino's Pro Wrestling This Week, and the conventions when I'm doing book signings, what do they talk about? PWI.
Yeah. I mean, it was an unbelievable, I don't think the modern fan, if they were not born after a certain date, can understand how important it was to get that every month and all the different personalities of all the different columnists in there, whether they were real or fictional too. But
well, the thing that irks me is people think that Dan Shockett and Eddie Illner were not real. Dan died at an early age. He had cancer. And Eddie, if you go onto Facebook, Eddie has a business called Yoga Soup.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And Brandy Minkiewicz exists. I just saw her Sunday at a party that Craig Peters threw for his lady friend. And I had seen Brandy in about 15 years, and she still looks fabulous. Stu Sachs still lives in my neighborhood. So, yeah.
So we're going to move on to something we call the three count now. It's going to be three quick questions and your answers.
I love it.
First one is, you always ask wrestlers who their toughest opponent was. Who was your toughest interview or your toughest photograph?
Toughest interview was one that never happened. It was Vince Jr. I tried 100 times to get him to interview, and it never happened. So that was tough, and I'm still pursuing it.
I would love to hear that. I think
I would too.
You're the perfect person to be able to interview him and cover what you need to.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, unquestionably, Mr. McMahon,
So we'll put that out there. So second question, we've gone to karaoke before. What is your go-to karaoke song?
It changes every, back here is my karaoke machine. It changes all the time. Yesterday it was Tom Jones. I've been in love so many times, thought I knew the score, but girl, you treated me so bad, I can't take anymore, and it looks like I'm never gonna fall in love again. So that was last night's.
Very good. Very good. I had a great time. The 2 times that we did it.
I enjoyed myself with you.
Fantastic. So fun. Yeah. I haven't gotten to do it too much lately. Only like once or twice in the last couple
of years. A lot of places closed because of COVID. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm down here every night. I have about 100 karaoke discs. I do Andy Williams stuff. If I don't know the words, I don't sing it, by the way.
Yeah, that's tough to pick up something you don't really know that well.
No, I won't do that. Barry Manilow stuff, Andy Williams, Steve Lawrence, Tracy Lawrence, the country singer, Toby Keith, nice. Engelbert Humperdinck, just one song of his, Taylor Swift. One day you'll be living in a big old city and all you're ever going to be is me. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Bill Apter is a Swifty, folks.
Yes. Oh, my God. I'm a fan of Low, though. Manilow's my
I like
we
that.
Just went to see him at Radio City a few weeks
How's
ago.
How's that?
And it was fabulous. He's still, his voice is so good. And he sang all his hits except my favorite one, Somewhere Down the Road. He missed that one. My favorite Manilow song.
That's great. And then last question, you get to start a promotion and you get to pick five wrestlers from any era. Who do you choose?
Oh, my God. Well, if I want to draw money, it would be Bruno, mm-hmm. Flair, The Undertaker. I need that Avon Eric. And I'm trying to John Cena. Yeah, that takes in all the eras.
Any particular member of the Von Erichs?
Kerry,
okay.
And I still talk to Kevin.
Very, very good. And no Mil Máscaras there?
Oh, actually, yes, Mil Máscaras for sure. So let's remove one of the...
There's no rules, really, so we can just add Mil.
Real name is Mil Máscaras. I have the mask. It's laying down here. That he debuted at Madison Square Garden. You can't see it because it's laying down. But, yeah, I still talk to him. He was the reason people always say he didn't want to do the job. Hulk Hogan, same thing. He's protecting the character. Yeah. And Mil Máscaras, to me, back in the 70s, watching him, his matches were like a ballet. He was so smooth. You know, put him in a hold. And there were a lot of guys – like Angelo King Kong Moscow, rest his soul, that wouldn't work. They worked with him, but anytime he'd do that flying press, they'd move right out of the way.
And he could move like that with a pretty big physique, too.
He had a huge physique, yes.
Yeah, he had a huge upper body. So, Bill, thank you so much for joining me today on Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations. Everybody check out his stuff on Sports Kita and on the YouTube channel he mentioned earlier.
Yes, Wrestle Binge.
Wrestle Binge.
Right, and you can follow me right here at After One Wrestling on Twitter.
Very nice.
And don't forget about my book.
Is wrestling fixed?
I didn't know it was broken. It's still on sale on Amazon. And it's the story of my career up to the past 7 years. And I'm not slowing down whatsoever, brother.
All right, Bill, thanks so much for joining me. Really enjoyed this.
Thank you, Phil. I enjoyed it, too.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining me today on Under the Ring Pro Wrestling Conversations. I'd like to thank Bill Apter for joining me today. It's always good to be with Bill. Check my Twitter at Under the Ring for the latest guest announcements. Have a great week, everyone. And as Bill Apter would say, we'll see you at the matches.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.